Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There are a lot of people questioning the direction of conventional economics right now, yet even after the biggest spending splurges ever made by governments outside wartime, there's still a lot of talk about fiscal conservatism, paying back the debt, balancing the budget, yet contrarian voices question whether that is the best way forward, whilst others are seeing an end to fiat money and are buying into alternatives. So, in this free half-hour podcast, we'll look at those questioning the way our economies are run and the contrarians who believe that there's a better way. Contrarians who don't always agree with each other, because not all contrarians are the same. That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Now, Steve, Jack Stocksley contacted me with a suggestion for this week's topic, which is to look at the various camps that have developed in economic theory, particularly since the global financial crisis, and why some are getting more traction than others, and perhaps not the most healthy ones are the ones getting the most traction, and how some of those contrarian ideas are still based on, you know, neoclassical theories and practices, others not. So an example is, and let's start with this obsession with Bitcoin. Now, this obsession is because people think fiat money is losing value because there's too much of it. So that is nothing more than the old-fashioned principle of scarcity, isn't it, really? There's nothing particularly new about this or healthy.
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin has got all... I mean, people are making large amounts of money. And I've got to say, I mean, Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert told me I should buy when it was 10 quid a Bitcoin, and I didn't, and I should have. I would have made a very, very healthy living out of that, thanks very much. But to me, it's never been money. What it is, it's harking back to the belief that money should be a commodity. Money should have intrinsic value. In other words, that's the basis of the enthusiasm for Bitcoin as a form of money. I think the other elements of Bitcoin are why I just don't think it'd ever take over, particularly its energy consumption, which I'm now told its energy consumption is equivalent to the energy consumption of Thailand. For the number of trades that Bitcoin actually supports, that's ridiculous.
But I mean, if you were to look at fiat money and how that's moved around in banks, and you were to add up all the costs of transactions through running those bank systems and the like, then maybe you'd find that that also came up with.
No,
that.
You don't. No, it's far cheaper. Mm. There's an intriguing set of things underneath Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin appeals to people who are have got an Austrian economic orientation.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the
so it is neoclassical
from.
Economic thinking, isn't it? That's driving the desire for Bitcoin.
No, it's really it is strictly Austrian. I mean, the neoclassicals don't even have money in their models. You know, The monetary system is just a bit of frippery you've got to have there as a veil over barter from the neoclassical.
Okay,
point
well,
of view.
So wrong phrase then. But it's I mean, it's
definitely
it's,
Austrian.
It's and very much conventional thinking. You know, the idea that people harking back to, you know, the loss of the gold standard, really, isn't it?
Fundamentally, I think that's true. I mean, speaking of Max and Stacey, Max is always was a gold bug and is now a Bitcoin bug. Mm. And you know, he originally said that gold is money, and that's what it should be the case. I've spoken to once a member of the Conservative Party who's on the Monetary Policy Committee for the British Parliament. He's simply said gold is money. You know, so there's this belief in a commodity as money, and gold is
but gold,
you know,
backed
by the
gold
wayside.
Backed money. Gold wasn't money. Gold ultimately gold backed money. Bitcoin is not backing anything at all. I mean, there's no currency tied to Bitcoin. We had currencies tied to gold. I mean, that's the big difference. There's no monetary element to Bitcoin because he can't use it because it's too, as you say, too expensive. And you know, other factors as well, like, you know, it's multinational. You're not going to buy anything on Amazon with using Bitcoin, are you?
Well, what you have is people are now, like, you know, Bitcoin, there are all sorts of other flaws in its design, the main one being the energy consumption that's necessary to enable the mining, to then reward the miners, to keep the private creation of Bitcoin rolling. But people have then got the Lightning Network sitting on top of that, and transactions occur at the Lightning level, and they're a lot cheaper and a lot faster than Bitcoin. That is still happening there. But the number of transactions, I mean, it'd be intriguing if we can find how many transactions are actually financed by cryptocurrencies. It certainly is. If it was 1% of global commerce, I'd be surprised.
Mm. But even if it was 100%, say we all went down the Bitcoin road, and it was used as a transactional currency. I mean, there's an upper limit. I think it's like 20. Hence the idea of scarcity is what's driving, isn't it? I think there's, once it reaches 20.
The idea of scarcity. I mean, it's a weird form of scarcity because then there are only 21 million Bitcoin. You can what's the smallest unit of Bitcoin? Is it a millionth or that you can actually buy? It can be divided down to such a small level.
Which is still a lot of money. But if it becomes a common currency, if a country exclusively used Bitcoin, and we know there's only going to be 21 million, I mean, prices couldn't go up, could they? If production in that country goes up and people want to buy more, and you've only got a limited amount of money in circulation, prices would have to go down. It can only be deflationary, can't it? So that is a real problem.
That's effectively the concept, that your currency would deflate.
Is that a good thing?
Bitcoin, the thing which appeals to people like Bitcoin above all else is that its value rises over time. And this is something which actually saw Neil Ferguson having a discussion about just recently as well, where I quite agreed with him. Money, if we talk about money having three characteristics, is money is a store of value, a means of account, and a form of a enables transactions. And he said, I don't know, that his comment was that maybe there are the three are exclusive, because if you're going to use it as a store of value, then you want it to rise in value over time, or at least maintain its value. If you want to use it for transactions, you want it to turn over rapidly. But if you have something which is highly valuable, it's not desirable to spend it. I mean, we had the classic stories of somebody who, way back in 2010, bought a pizza with a Bitcoin. Yeah. He hadn't bought the pizza. He could now buy a pizzeria with the Bitcoin. And therefore, it encourages you not to spend, which goes against the whole purpose of money.
Well, yeah. Well, and actually, there wouldn't very much to buy either, would there? Because people are not going to borrow. You're not going to borrow to invest because when you've got a deflationary currency,
you have to pay back more. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you borrow a Bitcoin, have to pay a Bitcoin back in a year's time. You're paying an effective interest rate of 100%. Given the current rate of growth of Bitcoin.
So no one will be buying anything, and there'll be no investment. But apart from that, so that's a brilliant way to run a country.
And the other thing about it is that it's something which, if we actually did convert over to cryptocurrencies tomorrow, then everybody who's bought cryptocurrencies would be a millionaire, and everybody who hadn't would starve to death, and that'd be the end of your social system. So it's something which it actually requires a level of community buy-in that it doesn't exist at the moment, and I don't think it ever will.
Well, it won't. I mean, because the advocates say, look, it's finite, it's peer-to-peer, it's borderless, it's honest because it's got this transparent ledger, and there are no gatekeepers. All of those very good reasons for countries like they have in China to say, well, look, we're not going to have that going, running right in our country. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, Bitcoin, ultimately, I think will just become illegal, won't it?
My feeling is that it will be the energy crunch that does it, because we're going to find at some point some really unarguable catastrophe, not something as little as losing a small town in Canada, or having one of Canada's major cities cut off by the rest of the country by a storm, and something that destroys a whole country happens, and people say, hang on a second, this is not what we thought the climate was about, and then we've got to cut our energy consumption back. How much can we afford to consume right now? 20% of our current output, because 80% is fossil fuel based. What's the easiest way to save energy? Shut down Bitcoin. And so I do expect that to happen
Even if that wasn't the case, I mean, the idea that it's borderless and it's peer-to-peer, which would mean, it could become a global currency where no government knows what the hell's going on. They have no control. There's no reason for any central banks. I'm sure actually Bitcoiners would probably say, well, that's the point. There is no need for central banks because it controls itself, because it's a finite currency.
And that's back to the proto-anarchist elements of Austrian economics, because they really believe there shouldn't be a government. So a lot of this is driven by, again, the Austrian political economy perspective that the government is only there to stuff things up. We should get rid of the government and not have any government structure whatsoever. And to do that, we need a form of money which is not government-based. So here's a Bitcoin.
Right.
So it is an Austrian wet dream.
So at the very opposite end of the extreme is modern monetary theory. So if you are a supporter of modern monetary theory and Bitcoin, take a long, hard look at yourself, because they are poles apart. One is advocating extending their money supply to pay for more government services and create more jobs. And as we've said, Bitcoin is the exact opposite of that, isn't it?
Yeah. So we do have rival camps turning up. So in terms of intellectual foundations, I've got far more time for modern monetary theory than the Austrians and the Bitcoin end of the spectrum, as you'd appreciate.
Mm.
A large part of it is that a country, there is such a thing as a country, there is such a thing as society, contra Maggie Thatcher. And if the government is spending more than it's taking back in taxation, then it's actually adding to demand and adding to your spending power, not subtracting from it, which is what it should be doing. So it is a very different perspective on what we're doing. And what it's really saying is that the neoclassical management of the economy that says the government should try to run a surplus is contradicting the function that a government should fulfill in a well-functioning capitalist economy of providing the most of the money that's used to enable private commerce.
So it's understandable, isn't it, that people who play the markets are not going to be that interested in MMT. They are, because MMT will take away some of their financial instruments, they are going to be interested in Bitcoin because it's all just speculation, which is, of course, what they love.
But the other thing is that a lot of people in the markets, and like Warren Mosley himself, discovered these principles by being a trader. Mm. A lot of them have used modern monetary theory as a basis for doing their trades and have come out of it very nicely. And those that have a sort of neoclassical convention perspective, a lot of them, for example, looking at Japan, would think, oh, Japan's running as huge government surpluses. At some point, people aren't going to be willing to buy Japanese bonds. Therefore, the Japanese yen is going to depreciate. Well, that's called the widowmaker trade, okay? Mm. Because it's the modern monetary theory point of view, the government can run any deficit it likes as long as it doesn't cause inflation. And in my contrary point on MMT, if it doesn't cause you to go into a trade deficit, Japan had the trade surplus, so it was insulated to enable the government to spend as much as it wished to counter the impact of the private debt bubble that burst back in Japan in 1990, which they've done. So Japan's now got a government deficit, a debt level of 260% of GDP, and the economy is still sailing along quite nicely. So
yep.
Traders who took an MMT perspective ended up doing very well out of Japan, and they could simultaneously have done very well out of Bitcoin.
And there's no way Japan's going to change that situation either, because they've got an aging economy as well. So there's always going to be a lot of public money needed. But it's interesting, isn't it, when things in the world go awry, what does everyone buy? They buy out the Japanese yen because it's seen as being a safe haven currency.
Yeah, and also the American. Returns.
Yeah, but things went good. Yeah, exactly. But when things aren't going well in America, they also look to the yen as well. So, look, traditional economists, the mainstream, of course, tend to lump everyone together. If you're not with them, then you will have heard all these. You're either, take your pick, Steve, what are you, a Marxist, socialist, or a communist? Because they're all the same thing, really, aren't they? They're all bad, and they all screw up the economy. But then, what about the idea of, basically socialism? It's still alive, isn't it? You've got the likes of Richard Wolff, for example. Would you say he's a socialist
he's a socialist, yeah. I mean, the word socialist, again, is a bit of a rubber band. So if you look at the Communist Manifesto and see what the demands were in the Communist Manifesto, yes, there were kind of claims about taking over the commanding heights of industry, but there are also demands for universal suffrage and universal health benefits, which are the sort of things that the social democratic countries of Europe have all provided for their people, and they're very vibrant capitalist economies with a strong social democratic state. So socialism per se would mean no more profit motive, the sort of 100% state ownership of industry, which is what was the rule in Russia and in China before Deng Xiaoping, and that when you look at its competitive success against America, against capitalism, it was a failure. It didn't succeed. And that was a major reason why, when the Berlin Wall was knocked down, it was knocked down from the east rather than the west. But when you now look where we've got to in the state of the ecological catastrophe we're in, a lot of young people are looking at it and saying capitalism is what's screwing the ecology, so capitalism has to go.
And are we? Do you sense that we are moving a little bit away from that generally? I saw a video with Richard Wolff talking about how unprepared we were for the pandemic because of the profit motive, which focuses on the stockpiling of medicine. Actually, interestingly, we spoke about it the year before the pandemic as well. We did a podcast on how how medicines were overly commercialized. But you know, this idea of stockpiling, and we've seen that with energy, we've seen it with land, of course, we've seen it with money itself, and without regulation, those with power obviously can hang on to these things and control them for their own benefit. But if you try and regulate it, well, that's communism. But I think maybe the tide's turning a little bit, or am I just being overly optimistic? Maybe we.
No, I think the tide is turning. I mean, you look at. I have been a fan of Janos Kornai's work. Janos died just a couple of weeks ago. Actually, Janos Kornai, brilliant Hungarian economist, and he wrote, I think, what is the best analysis and criticism of socialism, to say that what you got out of a socialist system, even one without all the travesties of Stalin and Mao and so on, was likely to give you an industrial sector which didn't innovate, and therefore you'd get stagnation over time, which is, if you know, what really happened in Russia was stagnation and lack of industrial technological development over time, whereas America had booms and busts, but it had technological development. So that was a major reason for people to become disillusioned with Russia and pro-capitalist, which is what you certainly saw in all the peripheral states of the Soviet Union after its collapse. But now that we're facing ecological catastrophe, and we've got a young generation that didn't experience the Berlin Wall and to whom the Cold War is, a set of movies their parents watch, they are now much more pro-socialist and critical of capitalism in general and say, yes, there should be public ownership of everything. I think in terms of the political power of the ideology of socialism, it's stronger now than it has been ever since the Great Depression.
So it's interesting how you got people coming at this from different angles. So we mentioned Richard Wolff. There's also people like Peter Schiff, who's got a very long podcast, which I think is almost every day. He plays on the financial markets, and everyone who plays on the financial markets likes to talk. He's in some ways, he's not a Bitcoiner. You know, he thinks Bitcoins are like Ponzi schemes, even though he's a financial marketeer. Also thinks, though, that expanding the money supply is inflationary. So he's not a modern monetary theorist, and he sees no sense in schemes like Biden's most alliterative legislation ever, Biden's Build Back Better bill. So he's against that. So he sort of sits in the middle. And that's the thing, isn't it? There's so many people coming at all of these things from different angles, and I'll take a bit of this over here, but disagree, like you, with modern monetary theory, but not with them on their exports, and that's why we've got a very fragmented. We've got a lot of people challenging the orthodoxy, but not a lot of cohesion in terms of how everyone's attacking it.
Yeah, no, it's the let a thousand flowers bloom stage when the flowers aren't the world's most attractive roses. It is quite crazy how fragmented political and economic ideology is these days. Because you're talking about support for socialism, for example, without talking about a labor movement, because there is really no effective labor movement anymore. The unions have been busted over the last 40 years. But even given that, you've now got this strong push for socialism, which is coming out of young people and an environmental interest, not coming out of working class people in factories who want better conditions. So it's an incredibly confused situation. I think it's in some ways that is a sign that we are going through a breakdown because there's just, the system is, leading to catastrophes like COVID, the ecological stuff we're seeing, with Canada leading the way at the moment in climate change dangers. And we have the effect of austerity in Europe, meaning people are angry about the state and angry about capitalism at the same time over there. And then America, heaven help us. So, it's an ideological nightmare these days.
Yeah, and even in sort of the orthodox circles, they're disagreeing on stuff. So central banks really haven't got a clue what to do right now, and they're all going off in different angles. So some are saying, like Europe, well, we're going to keep on our track. We're going to keep on buying up bonds, and we're going to do that for the foreseeable future. And then you've got New Zealand on the other, in completely opposite side of the spectrum, that are pushing up interest rates next, have just done it and going to do it a few more times next year. So they think. Yeah, exactly. Watch the wait for the U-turn, folks. Yeah. So you can see Jack Stocksley's point then, who got us going off down this avenue, that you know, there's a lot of people who think there's something fundamentally wrong with the way the economy is managed right now and the theory surrounding it. But try and figure out how and why. It's a question for a lot of people who go down that road. Who do you turn to? Well, obviously you turn to Steve Keen and you're listening to this podcast. But I mean, you're just one voice out of many.
I know. And like the in one sense, there's a coherent voice, which is the post-Keynesian approach to economics. It partly subsumes modern monetary theory as well. And that's quite a consistent form of analysis. And
so tell us more about that then. So what is the post-Keynesian school? I hate that term, but anyway, I thought we'd be beyond school. But, you've got the post-Keynesians. Mm. So you're sort of adding to, what is it you're adding to what Keynes stood for? And how do you differ from, for example, neo-Keynesians, new Keynesians? I mean, you know, how can anyone be expected to keep up with this?
The fundamental difference is empirical realism. Because if you see what led to the development of the post-Keynesian school, it was, of course, first of all, Keynes's general theory during the Great Depression. And there you had an event which, according to mainstream economics, could not happen, a long-lasting slump, massive unemployment, 25% peak in America, fell down to 11% by 36. The government then followed the advice of fundamentally Austrian neoclassical economists to rebalance the books, unemployment back up to 20% again. Out comes Keynes's book, and that's where it got adopted in the community. But what got adopted was Hicks's variation on Keynes, which said that investment can be controlled by the rate of interest. And what he left out of the thinking was Keynes's argument that investment depends upon expectations of profit, and expectations of profit are highly volatile. And therefore, expectations are far more important, and it's expectations in an uncertain world. So,
which is easy to demonstrate right now, because we've seen lack of investment, even though interest rates are very low, because everyone's going, well, what happens next?
Yeah, you don't know what's going to do, so you don't invest. You forget lowering interest rates aren't going to stimulate investment when you're worried about the future. Equally, high interest rates won't stop you investing if you're optimistic about the future. And then those expectations are shared in a herd behavior sort of way. Keynes's chapter on that, chapter 17 in the general theories, the one part of the general theory, I think if you read any part, you should read chapter 17. And then also with the General Theory of Employment paper in 1937. So that's where the post-Keynesians effectively thought, this sounds like not ideology anymore, but realism. You know, yes, it's realistic that people invest on the basis of profit expectations. It's realistic that money is created by banks. It's realistic that firms face declining costs as they manufacture. We need to assemble a theory that is based on these empirical regularities that describes capitalism accurately. And that's been, if anything, unites post-Keynesians, who differ on a whole range of other things internally in terms of how they actually implement that realism. It's the emphasis upon, is this assumption realistic? And whereas the neoclassicals said, oh, the less realistic the assumptions, the more powerful the theory, which was a way of sidestepping the fact that their theory had internal logical contradictions that only a stupid assumption could help them sidestep. So this is why I think the post-Keynesian is the least ideological of the approaches to economics, because it began from the point of view saying we have to be realistic in the way we describe capitalism.
So the neo-Keynesians are basically those people that you've described who took in the words of Hicks.
Yeah.
And so it's all about interest rates, because that is the interesting thing, isn't it? Irrespective of where you are, everyone seems quite happy to quote Keynes.
That's one of the troubles, yeah. Paul Krugman calls himself a Keynesian. And with the Keynesian he's talking about is a Keynes who was constructed by Paul Samuelson and John Hicks. all around the idea of investment being determined by the rate of interest, savings being if people don't consume, therefore they're saving. So savings causes investment. It's a reworked version of 1870s neoclassical thought, which is what Hicks himself admitted in the early 80s, that he got it all wrong and terribly sorry for what I've done for you for the last 50 years. But we don't have a foundation in realism. And this is one reason that I find the whole system dynamics approach so appealing, because if you take a look at the work of Jay Forrester, who's the one who established system dynamics as a general way of approaching dynamic systems, he was inspired by 3 months of reading mainstream economics. And he was so horrified by what he read. He said, we've got to build an alternative to this, which is based on realism. What you're trying to do with a model is to build a representation of reality that behaves much the same way as reality does, and therefore you can poke your model in some way and see what happens and say, that's what happens if you try the same thing in reality before you actually do it. That's the only real benefit of a model. And that focus on realism is what distinguishes post-Keynesians in general and then the system dynamics approach as well, the complex systems stuff that I'm into, from all the ideology of Marxists at one extreme and Austrians at the other.
Yeah, there you go, Steve King, bringing reality into it again. No wonder people are confused. There's a problem with models, though, isn't it? Because there are people will go, oh, yeah, you've got a model. You know, it's like the people distracting against measures to try and control COVID. You know, they'll go, oh, yeah, they've got their model, but, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. You know, and show us the model. And, of course, there's nowhere in the world they'd be able to understand the model if you did show it to them. And so what you're doing in terms of most people's views, particularly people who want to detract from what you're doing, is you're just creating a black box where you putting stuff in and saying, hey, look what I got out.
Well, that's unfortunately what neoclassicals have done. They've given modeling a very bad name because, I mean, like, I've just been, I'm doing a lot of work on climate change these days. And there was a paper that I'm writing a critique of for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And in that paper, they said they were going to use an earlier model as a sensitivity check on their model's estimates of damages from tipping points in the climate. And this particular model assumed that, first of all, damages were quadratic, so you could fit a parabola to say what's going to happen to the economy as temperatures rise. You know, the damage will be some constant times temperature squared. And they also assumed that one of the points on this parabola was 2.5 degrees Celsius will cause 2% damage to the environment. And where did they get those numbers from? They made them up. When you take a look at it, they said, well, the 2%, that's fair enough. That's what the government is spending right now on environmental protection. But the temperature at the time that they said that was no more than half a degree over pre-industrial levels, not, as they assumed, 2.5 degrees over industrial levels. So they simply made it up. And you look at it and think, this is garbage. You've made a garbage assumption. You get a garbage result. So the public skepticism about the models that economists use is quite justified. And when you compare them to the models that scientists and mathematicians and epidemiologists build, then those models are far more reliable. There may be an assumption which leads you astray at various points, but the models that the hard sciences do are decent attempts to do to give you a realistic simulating picture of the real world and then use that to guide your policy. The stuff that economists have done, it's no wonder modelling has a bad name.
So the problem with carrying people on, or helping people investigate is because, you know, as we've explored today, there are so many different branches, and there's people that you agree with on some stuff and not on others. You know, for example, with the modern monetary theorists on imports and exports, there'll be people who are ardent fans of you, but not completely swayed by the climate change argument, for example. So there's people
believe me, I get a lot of that.
I'm sure you do. Absolutely,
and stuff on COVID as well. Yeah,
but how do you wrap it all up? I mean, if we started by talking about, you know, Bitcoin versus modern monetary theory, which is the difference between, you know, scarcity and money supply, which then gets you down to the question about, well, is it big government versus small government? And does everything, which actually branches off, are you a left winger or a right winger?
This is where I come back to system dynamics, which of course is the basis of my Minsky software. The idea of system dynamics was to build as complete a rendition of the real world as you could do in simulation form, and then see what happens when you poke it. And if you like, I really do recommend reading some papers by Jay Forrester back in the 50s when he was coming up with a general concept, because he was saying that with a computer, we can actually simulate some elements of the real world faster than they happen in the real world. Obviously, a cut-down version of the model. You don't have a model of every person on the planet in your computer. But you try to build out general characteristics and how one part of a system affects other parts of a system. And that is what system dynamics enables you to do. And he said, if you build a model based on that ground, you will have a realistic picture of the system you're looking at. And that it hasn't penetrated economics. The dominance of neoclassical thinking overall and the equilibrium approach, and the fact that they do the teaching, means that even people in economics have become, you know, heretics like myself. Most of them don't even know of system dynamics as a potential alternative approach. And I think there's about two dozen people who work in system dynamics and economics. I know every last one of them. I'd be probably fine if you see, you know, I don't know the PhD students, but I know all the published professors.
And are you all drawing similar conclusions?
Yes, this is the thing. Because we're using similar foundations, where realism drives what our models are built on,
give me a couple of common conclusions that you've all drawn from systems.
Well, fundamentally, the monetary system, we concur with modern monetary theory on that approach. The need for investment driven by uncertainty. So your feedback that determines, fundamentally, your expectations of the rate of profit are the main thing driving cycles in capitalism. Capitalism is cyclical. You won't have equilibrium. So all these, and also things like the production systems, resilience can break down. If you have a long supply chain, then that is easily breached. The dangers of just-in-time, the advantages and dangers of just-in-time manufacturing at the same time, the fact that if you have a system with lots of buffers, it's harder to destroy it with exogenous shocks. If you have a streamlined one, it's easier to destroy it with exogenous shocks. So what you find is people who work in system dynamics are really applying a general tool approach to a range of issues, and because the tool itself is correct, it's basically saying things take time. Okay, that's, if you wanted to boil it down to its essence, system dynamics is you must include the time dynamics and feedback effects in any system you look at. And it gets incredibly complicated to tie them all together, but the software enables you to do that. And then you have an interacting complex system. And for that reason, conversations with system dynamics people are really quite straightforward. Whereas if you get involved with a conversation with an Austrian or a Marxist, I mean, you're stuck in, you know, talking about subjective value of theory versus the labor theory of value, and you find yourself caught up in a bloody religious conversation, not a practical one.
Yeah, but I don't know. You know, these systems dynamics people, they just sound to me, Steve, like a bunch of commie bastards who are just trying to build up arguments, to build up numbers to try and defend their cases.
There you go.
I mean, that's, you know, I'm sure you get that a lot.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, for example, I'll give you one example where system dynamics changed my mind, because and this is very recent. You remember, you and I used to have conversations about how does the government create money? And I used to tell you that I thought so much of the government money creation was equivalent to a number of bonds bought by the central bank. Mm. Now, when I read the only thing that surprised me in Stephanie Kelton's The Deficit Myth, because I agree with everything else, was the argument that the deficit itself creates money. I thought, well, it's about time I modeled this in Minsky. So I just got out my Minsky software and put the model in there. And Stephanie was right and I was wrong. The modern monetary theory is correct there and I was wrong on this point. It's the deficit itself that creates money, and it also creates the reserves that are used to buy the bonds. So the proportion of the bonds that are bought by the central bank is irrelevant to money creation. Yeah. There's also bonds being sold by the private banks to the non-bank public. That actually destroys money or converts money into bonds. So it's not as completely straightforward as the deficit is 100% of the equivalent to money creation. It's actually about 20%, because so many bonds are sold to non-bank financial institutions in particular. But that was a point where I looked at the system dynamics and that told me my original expectation was wrong. So I've changed my mind. That annoyed some people, but that's what made me change my mind, looking at the system dynamics.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. Well, that is hopefully the future, Steve, and it'll bring people together. But I don't know how we answer poor Jack as to where he goes next. Give him a couple of books that he should be reading.
Debunking Economics, of course.
For sure.
But also I'd highly recommend, this is the thing I'm delighted to see, I've been a great advocate of John Blatt's book, Dynamic Economic Systems, A Post-Keynesian Approach, which was out of print for 20 or 30 years. And now I found that not only is it back in electronic form, it's now being republished, I think, in hardback and paperback. So I'd say get that book as well. The one thing that drove Blatt was the need for realism, and which is why I called it, having been a pure math, one of the world's great applied mathematicians, he ended up becoming a leading developer of post-Keynesian economic thought, because from a mathematician's eye, that was the only approach to economics is based on fundamentally on realism. So Blatt's Dynamic Economic Systems and my Debunking Economics. And, you know, why not buy the new one as well?
So, and we, you know, maybe you and I should write a book. Maybe that could be.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. We should start that one day. Yeah.
let's think about that. So is this a reality school? Is that what we're talking about?
It's fun. Really? It's reality school. I mean, that's well put, because what we're trying to do with a model is a mental representation of an existing system. And what we're saying is you want to have a realistic representation of that system. And what drives both system dynamics in general and then the post-Keynesian school of economics as an instance of economic thought overall is a desire to have realism as the basis of the model. And Whereas everywhere else you look, you get a form of ideology.
Great. I've enjoyed that. I hope Jack did too. Catch you again next week. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, mate. Bye.
Now, if you enjoyed that, we do a podcast every week, half an hour a week, or 40 minutes sometimes if we babble on too much. And you can hear all of them in full if you subscribe at debunkingeconomics.com or become a supporter of Steve Keen on Patreon at patreon.com/prof Steve Keen. We always release about 10 minutes of each episode so everyone can have a listen. But if you want to hear it in full each week, then become a subscriber and tell your friends about it. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you again next week.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.